Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Hi, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Xiao Juan, and I will be your host for our weekly Global Awakening Call today. Welcome and thank you for joining us. Today, our special guest speaker is none other than Sierra McNamara, and someone who really embodies today's theme of building a community sanctuary for stillness and inner wisdom. Our guest this week believes that each person has within a reservoir of wisdom, creativity, and resilience, that even in the midst of life's most tumultuous moments, there exists in everyone an undisturbable place of clarity that arises with awareness in the present moment. In times of tumult, how have you tapped into your inner reservoir of clarity, wisdom, and creativity? What practices or environments allow you to access that place more regularly? Since we have the pleasure of our remarkable moderator, Raul, today, I thought we could just start by asking him to kick up our circle. So, Raul, thank you for joining us, and I'd like to hand over the mic.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Xiao, for that introduction. The call theme is particularly interesting for me because I think meditation, and just finding stillness within, as well as service, have really just been anchors for my own journey and really have propelled, I think, any of the progress that I've made in life. And so it's really remarkable to be speaking with someone who's really making that available to so many other people. Sierra McNamara is actually an entrepreneur and the founder of Mayu Sanctuary, which is a meditation co-op and community right in the heart of a very busy neighborhood in Denver. And I think through its classes and services, so many people who wouldn't otherwise be connected to a practice like this have been able to find an entryway and a gateway and a support system through which to find those spaces of inner stillness and wisdom within that really are the basis for allowing them to grow and sort of work through challenges and kind of, improve their lives. So, Sierra, thank you so much for joining us today. Delighted to have you.
Thank you so much for the invitation, Raul. I look forward to talking with everyone.
Oh, Sierra, you were sharing a very interesting story about the origins of how Mayu, how the idea for Mayu arose during, this time that you were working as a massage therapist. Could you tell us a little bit more about what you were noticing there and how that inspiration actually sparked up?
Yeah, I was working as a massage therapist and had been in the industry for about 7 years before this idea for Mayu started to bubble up. And it came very much from noticing the immediate effects of a massage on someone. You know, in the course of 60 minutes, it's very easy to see an enormous transformation in most people from the moment they walk in your door before the treatment to after the treatment, when their whole body is relaxed, the muscles in their face are relaxed, their eyes are soft, their speech is slower. And I never got tired of seeing that sort of transformation in people. And I began to wonder, as I could see that massage therapy had I had a lifespan in the career as my body was getting a little bit more tired, and knowing that I could only do about 4 or 5 clients a day and knowing that there was a much larger need out in the world. And I began to think, what could we do to help people have that type of transformation, but without the therapy treatment, without the massage? Could it be done? What is it in this hour that I spend with people that is the magic point, you know? And I wasn't entirely convinced that the magic ingredient was the massage. You know, maybe that was just the excuse that got people in a quiet place, somewhere where they were giving themselves permission to slow down, to become more internal rather than external. So that was really the impetus for the curiosity and wondering what is really happening here inside of someone and for them, and is it possible to replicate that in a manner that would look completely different than a massage? But that was where it all began.
Interesting. So given that it was kind of noticing this interplay between maybe the environment itself and then what you're actually doing with them on the massage table, what were your insights around kind of the degree to which people's stress is maybe, or their relief from stress is a function of environment versus anything that's happening on a more physical level, or maybe kind of mind versus body?
Yeah, that was always at the forefront of the idea, simply because I'm very aware of how I feel in different spaces. The architecture of a space has always been very interesting to me. As I've gotten older, I've appreciated a lot more of kind of mixed indoor-outdoor foliage, garden spaces, lots of natural light. And so I took a lot of care in my massage space to design something that I felt was probably my ideal sort of getaway, with the fountain and the lighting and the textiles and the colors and the textures. And so I enjoyed that part of the brainstorming aspect of designing this kind of tranquil meditative space for people, wondering for the general population and people coming from a wide range of backgrounds, is there a unifying type of calming, comforting sort of environment that would be required in a space such as this? And it was easy to land on the natural elements, particularly the calming elements of water and fire with candles and firelight and foliage, of course. But given those broad parameters, I did spend many, many years in my mind and out in the world trying to find different inspirations, different buildings, color schemes, looking through magazines, looking at photos that I saw that might make me want to just put a meditation cushion in the corner of that photo and see if we could bring it to life in the real world. So I had always told friends and family that I was discussing the idea with that it would be ideal if we could find a location and a space that would do half the work for us, meaning a place where the moment they walked in, by everything that we have brought into the space design-wise, that they would immediately begin to feel more calm, more balanced, with a sense of harmony. And then everything else that we offered there in terms of services and whatnot, that would just be additional. But that we could create a space where we didn't really necessarily have to do too much, where they were already beginning to wind down and wind down the longer they were in the space.
I've often heard this saying about how environment is, especially in the initial parts of us trying to kind of calm down, environment is so much more powerful than willpower, meaning that, you know, someone in a very stressful environment is going to take on that regardless of their intent to kind of hold a space of inner balance unless they really have some practice. So,
I like that. I've not heard that, but I like that. I might use that in our meetings and in our classes.
Yeah. You know, Mayu also is intentionally not tied to any denomination or particular tradition. And quite interestingly, you didn't have much of a formal meditation practice when you kind of evolved this idea of really creating this meditation space. Can you tell me a little bit more about how meditation then became part of what was so clear was central to what she wanted to offer in this space.
Yeah, it was a little backwards, perhaps, how other people might have come to begin a meditation center. And I think it was primarily a function of how it all came to me as an inspiration of a quiet, beautiful, tranquil space that just happened to incorporate a lot of meditation and contemplative activities rather than starting off as an idea for a meditation center, which may have, you know, predisposed me to thinking that we needed to then be aligned with a teacher or a lineage. So I, again, was going through my life journey with a lot of experience in body work and massage in particular, I guess with a lifelong interest in introspective and contemplative practices. And so for me, as I was designing and imagining the space and what would happen in the space and how it could be an intriguing place to go for people who may or may not, and generally probably wouldn't have experience with meditation already, that I knew what type of environment I felt would be very calming and welcoming, but the services and how it would work as a business, you know, remained to be seen. As I started developing the business plan, and I was realizing that what I was actually conceiving was some type of quiet, contemplative, devotional, reverent environment, and knowing that I wasn't wanting or needing to create something that has already been done in terms of a church or a temple or a meditation center already, it took me quite a long while to understand that what this was is actually some type of meditation center. And once I began to realize that, and knowing where my own experience was with meditation, maybe some people would say the lack of my experience with meditation, that just forced me to look around the city and see what else was out there, what types of options were available to people who might want to explore meditation, mindfulness, contemplative skills and programs. And it really dialed up the heat on who I wanted to be, not necessarily who I needed to be in order to run something like this, but also it was very well aligned with who I wanted to be and where I wanted to direct my life. So it was a very easy decision on my part in order to go out, find different programs, ended up doing some meditation retreats with some well-known teachers in California and New York, becoming a part of meditation groups here in Denver. And I think also with that being my path, it was easy for me to put myself in the place of folks who are just starting their own exploration into meditation so that we could design a center with the knowledge and awareness that many, many people are walking in the door for the very first time, often with a high level of hesitation or sometimes even intimidation about what they can expect and whether or not they're somehow prepared for stepping foot inside a meditation center. So I'm happy that it wasn't all that long ago, you know, maybe about 10 years ago, where I myself felt very naive and uncertain about the whole meditation world. And that, again, has influenced a lot of our decisions in how we run the center in terms of wanting to make everyone feel very, very welcome, not using special language or terms if we don't need to. At the store up front where we sell meditation supplies, we don't call them zafus and zabutons. We'll call them cushions and mats, and in a very deliberate way, doing what we can to make everyone feel like they belong in that space and not trying to talk over them or talk down to them.
Mm. Yeah, it occurs to me that is just a very passionate way to reach out to people, you know, to make things as accessible as possible. Yeah, I'm curious about the early days of Mayu, because you know, no one describes starting a business as something that leads to sort of more calmness in one's life. And at the same time, there does seem to be this principle that the things that you want the most in your life are, you know, if you kind of seek to give those away, it creates the space for more of that to come into your life. And here you are kind of creating the space of accessibility for people to reach kind of stillness and quietness. So tell me a little bit more about what was happening in those early years in terms of kind of the stress level, and also what the changes you were noticing in yourself in the process of trying to give away this kind of space of stillness.
That is a great question. It reminds me of the first 6 months, the first year. It was certainly a place where I was required on a daily basis, sometimes on an hourly basis, to make sure that I was walking the talk. You know, like you said, starting a business is probably the antithesis of anyone's definition of calm and peaceful relaxation. And yet, I mean, I'm looking back on it, I'm delighted that there was such a stark contrast, you know, almost a paradox of putting out fires on a daily basis in terms of, we've just gotten a phone call for a certain type of program. We'd like to say yes. We have no idea how we're going to put something like that in place. What would be the processes? And, you know, in a mad scramble, trying to look as though we have some experience in that little niche, for example. But even on a daily basis, just in terms of finding our suppliers and the instructors for the classes, and it just seemed like not a moment went by in any given day throughout those first years, perhaps, that didn't really require a steadfast root hold in a kind of meditation practice. Meaning, I should say at this point, I couldn't have made it through those early days without a handful of people right nearby and all around me. The staff that I had, some of them are still with me to this day, but we were able to look at one another, and every one of them had a very, very strong meditation practice themselves. And any time I would start to get very frazzled, confused, angry, all of that stuff, I would have these women around me where I could look at them in the eye and they would say, I think that there's another way to do this, or what if we don't give them an answer right now and we wait and pause, or here's what I might suggest, let's do this together in a different way, you know. And it was very much about a group of people putting their own very sincere meditation practice to the test, really, in this manner in which we're around new people, new personalities, new discussions and disagreements, and where it seemed always that this decision was the most important, possibly life-changing decision. Will we go in direction A or direction B? Of course, nothing was ever that cataclysmic. It just always felt that way in the beginning. And so it was a way for me, sort of in the early days also of my own meditation practice, to realize I had maybe two options. I could either abandon my meditation practice and just spend my days in a frenzy and sort of be hypocritical in the whole idea, or I could hunker down and trust that everything that I'd learned and taught and believed in was the avenue that was going to get us through the critical times. And so thankfully we landed on that second option, and to this day, and even really still, not a week or a month goes by where it's not required for me, and I would say for everyone else involved in the center at this point, to lean very, very firmly on our meditation practice, which is essentially just asking us to, you know, we can ask the superficial kind of mental questions, and that's important and necessary, but there's always a deeper question underneath there in terms of how does this resonate with our heart space? How does this resonate with the bigger vision? How does this resonate with our larger goals? And if there's a mismatch anywhere in those two, then we know that we have to really take some time, give it a pause, and bring a lot of space and a lot of inquiry around it.
Mm. That's beautiful. It's almost like, you know, the practice that you were going through yourself and the space of community that you had created amongst the staff who were there at the beginning was really the foundation of the space and the basis with which you could invite people into that kind of an experience, and that the all the stress, all the trial by fire is really kind of anchoring you in the fact that, you know, having some confidence that people can get through whatever it is that they're going through by kind of engaging with the practices and coming to the space and the community. So that's great.
Absolutely, yeah.
We had also spoken about how early in that period when Mayu got started, you were encountering lots of folks who had this question about a meditation center being a business, and sort of how that question informed the way you intentionally organized. Can you share a little bit about what was coming up from those people who had more experience with meditation centers and then kind of what it led to for you guys?
Yeah. So we began as an S Corp, you know, in the traditional manner of for-profit businesses, simply because I have no experience in the nonprofit world, but what I did know about them didn't feel like it was going to be a good match for the type of enterprise that I had in mind. I did consult for 3 years before opening with business mentors at the SBDC, which is a branch of the SBA. And so I was certainly getting a lot of business advice from the perspective of the for-profit model. And it seemed to be working well enough, though it's true that because anytime you're speaking of a meditation center, everyone would just normally assume that you're going to be a nonprofit. And it probably didn't help that our donation basis for our drop-in meditation services maybe implied that we were all donation-based like a traditional 501c3. So there was confusion for a lot of people. You know, I don't know that it necessarily affected the manner in which we did business. We just realized that a lot of people were commenting on, you know, how might I make a charitable donation at the end of the year, or something that implied that they assumed that we were a nonprofit, which generally led to us questioning, do they know something we don't know? Or is there a way, are we doing it wrong? Is there a way that we should be doing this differently, better? And the question always came up to the point where I probably would ask people around me, other folks involved in meditation centers or in the business world on a quarterly basis, are we doing this right? Is there another way that we should be operating? About 3 years into it, I ended up making a call to a lawyer who specialized in nonprofits, and I told her everything about what we do. She listened, she gave advice, and her parting advice was, you could convert into a nonprofit at this point, but if you did, you wouldn't be able to do A, B, C, D, and E the way that we have been doing. You would have to completely retool how you're making income over here. You'd have to let go of this aspect. And basically, by the end of the conversation, what she described didn't look anything like the meditation center that we had created. And I felt comforted actually getting off the phone with her thinking, all right, I have the definitive answer now. We are not supposed to be a nonprofit. Another year went by. And there was still these, some kind of question was always bubbling up. In part, it might be that we were very aware that in a lot of people's eyes, there's something maybe inherently suspicious about a meditation center also being a business, in particular a for-profit business. And it might have been in some of those subtle communications or our own internal feelings of, this is okay, right? This is okay to be engaged in commerce with a meditation center, right? We're doing a lot of good things here. We're convinced that this is a really important and worthwhile endeavor. It's okay, right? So there still was these, whispers of questions, I think, among us, and particularly for me from time to time. It led us to explore the idea of co-op, the co-op model of business. And once we were able to understand exactly how co-ops work, co-ops are actually corporations, for-profit corporations, long title is a cooperative corporation. And once we understood, oh my gosh, there's already a business model out here that is a for-profit model, and it fits all of our desires for being sustainable, transparent, equitable, democratic, on and on, the idea to convert then, after our fourth year, I believe, was the easiest decision I've ever made. So we are now a cooperative corporation, a co-op, and everything feels like the perfect match. It feels perfect.
And what is being a co-op actually mean in practice?
Yes, what it means in practice. So it is a category of taxable business models as outlined by the IRS, which is different than a benefit corporation or a B corporation that's starting to come up these days. So co-ops have actually been a business model since the mid-1800s. And what it essentially means is that the business is owned collectively by the members. The members may be called owners. We choose to call them members. It just depends on the business that you're in or the industry. Sometimes co-ops will be called, the owners will be referred to as owners, such as if all of the workers of a business are owning it collectively, or credit unions, or REI is a co-op as well. They're calling their owners members. So they're owned collectively by the people who use them. They are intended to be for providing products and services for their members specifically. That doesn't mean that other people who are not members or owners can't use the services or the products. That all depends on how the bylaws of the co-op are arranged and organized. For Mayu, the meditation center specifically, we allow non-members to shop in the store and to take classes, but membership is required to use the center for other things, our drop-in meditation in the private retreat room and this kind of thing. So co-ops are owned collectively by their members, and another very defining characteristic is that each person, each member, gets one vote and one vote only. So what this does is it ensures that no one can come in and either with a whole lot of money or a whole lot of influence or a whole lot of something else, they would not be able to take over 51, 52, 70% of the voting rights and, in essence, steer your ship off course, so to speak, which was really important to me at the time of considering the co-op conversion, because I could reflect back on some brands that I knew and loved, seventh generation, and there's an energy bar that began here in Denver called the Lara Bar, where the founders of a business might have all of the best intentions, and they are creating a business that is very socially responsible, environmentally responsible. And at a certain point in a successful business, you get to a stage of growth where a single person or a small group of people just don't have the time and the energy and the finances to take it to the next level. And right here is where I think a business is its most vulnerable, where you have to make a decision to either bring in partners for their money and resources and time and energy, or you're bringing in investors. And in a traditional corporate model, what that means is you're essentially, there's a high likelihood or potential that you're going to be selling your influence, you know, that these people, the investors and the partners, are going to be buying influence, because very often what they want in exchange for their resources is a say in how their investment performs. And so knowing that a lot of these other businesses that I'd admired and respected now often seem just a shadow of their former selves. I was very concerned that all of the work that I'd put in these initial years wasn't just for nothing at the time that we started looking for, you know, maybe some fundraising and investors. So by converting to the co-op model, we were assured that anyone who did want to provide equity, and that is one nice thing, that co-ops are able to raise equity from their members, but no one is going to get any more than one vote. And so it felt like, and co-ops very much are, a very stable and equitable and democratic type of model.
And what has it meant for the way that you run Mayu in terms of decision-making itself and maybe that team of people who are immediately right around you from the early days, or the current team that's around you now?
Yeah, in some ways it looks exactly the same. It's running exactly the same. And in other ways there has been a fundamental shift that makes me understand that what we're doing now and how we're doing it is miles better than where we started off. So because I was the owner, founder of the business, it was up to me with a lot of consultation. I was able to write the bylaws. And so I guess I would just like to say, if there are any business owners out there who might ever be considering converting to a co-op, rest assured that the one lasting bit of influence you get is that you get to determine the bylaws, and you get to say, here's what this business stands for, here's what our priorities are, here is our mission, our vision. And once you get that in writing and begin to open up to collective ownership, you don't have to be concerned that years and years and years down the road you won't recognize your favorite pet project. So I would just like to say that. So being able to have written the bylaws meant that I had full comfort and confidence in how we were going to proceed as a business. So essentially the biggest thing that shifted for us was that our monthly memberships that had previously been running more like a gym membership, where folks would renew every month their monthly membership, turned into membership shares, and they are essentially lifetime memberships. Now, our lawyer never likes me to say lifetime memberships because they can be revoked if someone is misbehaving. But essentially, membership is a lifetime membership, and members are understanding that there's a lot more to this word than just I belong somewhere or I have access to use something, but they're understanding that I am a vital, integral part in what is happening here, and I believe that most members are signing up with enthusiasm because they understand what a unique and helpful, sustainable kind of business model a co-op is. You know, once we explain to them, here's how it works, here's why you might want to take part in what we're doing here, their eyes kind of light up and they say, that is really, really something different going out there. That's a little bit better than Small Business Saturday or Keep It Local. You know, they're understanding this is about empowerment. This is about creating a strong sense of community with a lot of loyalty, and they're very anxious to sign up and be a part of it. So on that level, we have a group of members and owners, they're really the same thing, members around us that are our best form of advertising. They are our best, we kind of call them our marketing soldiers out there talking to their friends and to their family, saying, you won't believe what I've just found out about. This is a really remarkable place. You should check it out. And what that's done for me is take a lot of pressure off of my shoulders in terms of wondering, okay, as the years go by and as we have opportunities to grow, do we go in this direction or might we choose a different option and go in another direction? And these are questions that can keep a person up at night if for an owner or a couple of partners trying to decide, are these steps forward going to be the things that take us in a positive direction, or are they going to be the things that we regret in several years and have to rework because we made a big mistake? And so for me, what has been my sort of pervasive sense of comfort with the whole decision was that I understand that everyone around me is collectively rooting for the success of the center, and the advice they're going to give me and their voting rights that they're going to put, you know, on paper are going to reflect their best decisions on what we do to grow throughout the years, so that it's not all on me to wonder and decide and make the big choices. So the idea of collective conversations and collective decision making is a huge relief. Now, I know a lot of business owners might not feel that way. They might feel like, no, I really prefer to be at the top of the pyramid. But for me personally, it's been a remarkable relief.
Thank you so much for sharing all of that at length. You know, I brought it up because, as you I'm sure know, Service Space itself works entirely in the gift ecology. And as a result, I think there are a lot of people we interact with who are in the traditional business world who really are actually offering what they offer in, at least in their inner heart, in some form of a gift. But mm-hmm. it actually takes a tremendous amount of maturity to be able to go and function and thrive in the gift model because of the sort of tilling of the soil, really, you know, the creation of all the conditions that would allow that circle to be regenerative in a time frame that maybe fits with people's mortgage payments. So, you know, I think that something like this co-op model is very interesting. So
mm-hmm.
I applaud you for kind of having the courage to do that, and just thank you for sharing so much about it.
Yeah, I do wish more people knew about it. It is a remarkable business model that I think can carry over into many, many different areas of entrepreneurship and activism and such.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. I'm curious about how people find out about MindU and kind of what the experience is of a first-time visitor.
I'd say that people find out about us in probably two or three ways. Number one is we have a really strong presence in the neighborhood where we are. It's a very tight-knit community. Platt Park is a street in Denver. Pearl Street is the street in Platt Park neighborhood. And Pearl Street has a wide, eclectic mix of shops and boutiques and restaurants and small businesses smack in the middle of this neighborhood, which is, you know, probably heavy on the 20 to 50 demographic with lots of kids and dogs, and a lot of people are walking the neighborhood and walking the streets with their dogs and strollers. So we are very visible in the neighborhood, and I would say probably 50% or so of our members come from the neighborhood. But because we're offering something very, very unique, word gets out pretty quickly, and it gets out very quickly in the meditation community. So we've always worked very closely with other meditation centers in town, and they are quick to refer their students to MyU for either their meditation supplies or for our open hours. The drop-in meditation is a nice way for meditation practitioners to get a little what we call supplemental sitting, knowing that a lot of nonprofits are run by volunteers, and therefore their hours are often limited throughout the week. They might be open just 2 or 4, 6 hours a week. So practitioners can come to our center and still have their quiet, peaceful, meditative space regardless of what meditation technique they're doing. So those two channels have been the best for us, the neighborhood, word of mouth, and then also referrals within meditation centers as well. It's been interesting to see how some of our more broad-based advertising and marketing has fallen flat when we try to extend too much into the general population, running ads in the Denver Post or in larger publications where we're kind of sometimes brutally reminded that a lot of people in the general population just have no interest in meditation yet. So we've decided to keep it close to home. And the nice thing is that more and more people are curious about meditation. The Google searches are growing exponentially every year. And we show up really well on Google searches. So I'd say that would be our third manner in which people find us is generally through the internet and just searching meditation classes or supplies in Denver. So once they hear about us, their first experience when they come in the door, I would say that if somebody's brand new to meditation, I think from their replies, I don't feel that this is just my hope, but I do think that everyone is reassured and maybe feeling a sense of relief that they've just walked into is as open and welcoming as it was advertised. We see a lot of people who will come in and they might just take a couple steps in the door and they're looking all around and they're not quite sure if they're going to stay, if, you know, how is everything hitting them? Does it smell like a big wave of incense, or, you know, what are the people behind the desk like? I'm not seeing any turbans or robes. Okay, I'm feeling all right. They might take another couple steps in the door. And so I think that for people who are new to meditation in particular, when they walk in, there's a sense of, this looks like a pretty normal place. I see that there are meditation cushions for sale. There is, candles and prayer beads and meditation cushions. That's to be expected. And I'll just start asking about classes or how the whole center works. And then I'd have to say that for people who have meditation experience, once they come in the door, I think that they're not disappointed either, though it might not look like the center that they have practiced in, meaning we don't have pictures of deities, we don't have iconography. The space itself is very neutral in terms of religious or, you know, spiritual even affiliation. So even though they might not be seeing a shrine room, they might not be seeing statues, it's a pretty obvious meditation environment with cushions and chairs and no distractions and a quiet, peaceful space. So I feel that we've done a pretty good job at creating an environment where everyone from all walks of life feel welcome.
And I know that therapists and medical practitioners also recommend people to MyU, and it's part of the reason why on your webpage you've got those buttons that are like, you know, anxiety, anger, you know, stress, things like that. Tell me a little bit about how you engage with people who are coming in with something that they're struggling with and they're explicitly clear about needing help with.
Yeah, we certainly see a lot of people coming in for those reasons, and I'm really pleased that a lot of people will just come in and announce and say, my therapist sent me here. I think that shows already an immediate sense of acceptance and comfort, saying, I'm very, very stressed and things are not going so well in my life. And I am convinced that I need more tools than what I already have. So people will certainly be sent by their psychotherapists and, again, as you mentioned, by their medical doctors, particularly people with histories of high blood pressure or heart problems. So we did end up putting on the website, as you mentioned, the buttons for different, I call them our top five conditions that people will come in if they're not specifically looking for a spiritual meditation experience, and that is anger, anxiety, depression, grief, and pain, physical pain, chronic pain. And it's interesting how very often in our society we'll try everything possible, you know, all of the medications, all of the surgeries, all of the more well-known and I'd say well-respected therapies and techniques before we decide that maybe it's important for us to look inside our own mental habits and our own mind and our own belief system. That sort of seems to be the final frontier that no one really wants to voluntarily explore. So we have a lot of sympathy and empathy for people who are coming in and saying, I'm at my wit's end. This is my final exploration. What have you got for me? And sometimes it's that sort of sort of despair mode. And I say it lightheartedly, even though we know that people come in oftentimes in very, very severe states of turmoil. But there's that resignation of them saying, okay, I'm pretty sure that this won't work, or I'm pretty sure that I've got nothing to lose, so what have you got for me? And we did want to normalize that a bit by putting those links and the resources there on right there on the homepage for people who are going through that in their lives at the moment, simply because it is so prevalent. It is so almost ubiquitous that people are walking around and their stress is at a point where it is completely overtaking their well-being. And we felt that it was important to very publicly say, it's okay, you're fine, you're in the majority if you're experiencing any of these conditions. And here's how we feel meditation might be of benefit. So we've linked to book resources and CD resources, some guided meditation there as well. And even though it's far from a complete list, and for most people, we don't expect that sort of a self-serve remedy is going to be the only way or the best way for them to take care of themselves. By providing those resources and those links, our intention was to simply say, you're in the right place. There can be some benefit if you were to explore these options. We've got private meditation instructors and even therapists that we will refer out to, but that namely, just saying, it's quite all right. You're not. There's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with what you're going through, and just trying to normalize it for everyone.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, it's by the same token that people kind of refer, you know, therapists and doctors refer people to you. I know that. Mayu itself is also kind of like a gateway for people to actually connect to different traditions, if that's the way they want to go, despite the fact that you yourself are not affiliated with any denomination or tradition, and that you guys have you know, quite a developed relationship with all of the other centers around town. Can you tell me a little bit more about how you're interconnected with them and sort of how people end up flowing through between Mayu and the other centers, especially when they find Mayu first?
Yeah, we do like to make it very obvious that we don't have an affiliation, like you said, with a specific teacher or lineage or tradition. And because we don't, we can welcome teachers and instructors from a wide range of backgrounds to lead classes and workshops and retreats in our space. And though some people might think that there's a lot of conflict that could occur there or a lot of confusion, we find it's just the opposite, that the people who are coming to Mayu very often might be at such a stage in the beginning of their journey that it would never occur to them to go to a more formal meditation center where they might be met with a lot of iconography and, you know, deities and such when they're maybe just looking for a little stress relief or relaxation. And so what we knew we could do is provide a broad palette of techniques and teachers and teachings all in one place, and trusting that everyone who walks in is ultimately, you know, working with themselves and their own soul space, their own heart space as the authority, and allowing them to attend a lot of different classes and lectures, meditation retreats, and then learning which ones are the best fit when there's a nice match, when they feel a resonance with a teacher or a teaching. And when they do, very often these teachers have their own centers, or sometimes they'll just be teaching in other places around the city where we can say, here is where now you can go to get the complete full experience of what it is to dive very deeply into this line of inquiry and of meditation and contemplation. So that's been a nice thing for us to be able to offer, is that folks can come and sort of dabble and explore the different teachings, because there are just endless different types of meditation techniques and teachings. And we also are able to sort of exist as a forum for other teachers to get more exposure. You know, a lot of times we hear from teachers of nonprofit groups saying, you know, we sure would enjoy a little bit more membership in our center. We just need a little more exposure. So might we come in and teach some programs here at Mayu as a way for us to get in front of your group of curious practitioners and see if there's a match? And if so, you know, we've got our own program and our own temple over here. So it seems to be a win-win for everyone. The students get a good perspective on traditions, the teachers themselves get a new format, a little more exposure. Mayu as the center gets to act as sort of the networking space and the meeting space for all of these people and teachers. So it's been a really tremendously beneficial sort of model for us to work with.
Thank you, Sierra and Raul, for such an engaging conversation. For all the listeners on the line, if you have any reflections or questions, please hit star 6 on your phone. And you can also email us ask@theservicespace.org. And Raul, do you have more questions to ask? And please continue.
Absolutely. You know, Sierra, it almost sounds like the cooperative model that you have for your members is all extending to sort of a cooperation amongst all of the meditation centers in town, you know, a very kind of mutually beneficial relationship has been established.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, maybe that was one reason why the co-op conversion was such an easy decision, because we were already in that space of collective decision-making and group processes, yeah.
And I know that this model itself is one that maybe like a couple of yoga studios on the coast or something are starting to adopt. I'm curious of whether you feel like this model for a meditation center is something that could grow or is growing, kind of, you know, in other parts of the country.
I would love to see it grow. I really would. I do feel that Well, I should say, for the way that we are doing business here with our meditation center, it is the ideal, perfect business model for us. That's not to say that it wouldn't be perfect, that another model wouldn't be perfect for another meditation center. Clearly, the nonprofit model has been working for a long, long time with a range of religious places of worship. I like it in regards to a meditation center simply because it does force you to put your principles into practice. It does remove that the potential stickiness of having a spiritual business be a money-making endeavor as well. So another aspect of the co-op model is that all co-ops are operating at cost. So all of the profits from a co-op must be retained within the co-op or be distributed equally among all of the owners. And so it precludes a CEO or someone at the top from just going in and cutting themselves a big check and taking a nice vacation or any other forms of corporate greed. The focus is not on the bottom line. They are business models that are running profitably, but the purpose of being in business is not for the profit motive, but instead for the motive of providing products and services for members. So an entirely different reason for engaging in business. So I do think that it bodes well for meditation centers and anything else that has at its core a type of very responsible and ethical reason for existing.
And I know that there's this other side of your work also where you develop this seat. Can you tell me more about the Mayu seat?
Yeah, the Mayu seat was probably this expression of the fact that there's always a creative undercurrent going on through the whole center. And I have to, of course, say the first iteration of the Mayu seat came from the man who became my husband, Sean McNamara, came in. He was a meditation instructor for many years before we opened our doors. We sent an announcement out to all the meditation instructors that we knew of in town once we opened and said, you might be interested to know, we now have a space for people to come practice on their own or for classes, and we've got a store for supplies. And he came in and said, this is what I've created as a meditation chair. I've never seen anything like it. I could see that my students were struggling, those students who couldn't sit on the floor, they were struggling with trying to have a nice upright ergonomic posture in a conference chair. So I myself designed this seat, and I took a look at it and went, that is a fascinating design that is serving a lot of purposes. We sold it for a while, and then he and I started revising it. I think we're now on the fourth or fifth iteration, and in between him coming in and looking around at the center and showing us this Mayu seat that he designed, a romance blossomed. We ended up getting married, and the Mayu seat is this nice little kernel of collaboration and creativity and passion, I think, that exists for us. So, sure, we'll give a little shout out to the Mayu seat now in its, like I said, maybe fifth or sixth iteration. We think it's the very best model that we've ever made. We look forward to sort of launching that into other meditation centers around the country. But, you know, it's hard to be engaged in something day after day, meaning selling meditation supplies or teaching meditation classes, and not be hyper aware that people's posture and their comfort in the practice is an enormously important part of what either makes someone run away screaming from meditation or has them feeling very comfortable and confident in their practice. So it was a natural extension of us saying there's a void here in what people are sitting on, there really needs to be something better, a much better design, a more functional seat. And so here we are. That was something very, very fun to collaborate on.
It's a great story.
Yeah.
Yes, Yara, I have a question, and I'm very inspired by your community building around the sanctuary you built for the community. And so my question, before the call, what makes you come alive? You said listening to people talk about their lives. When a person, particularly someone who isn't a close friend, trusts you enough to share a heartfelt or painful moment, and that space of courage and intimacy is a kind of soul nourishment. And when I read this, something really touched me. So I'm curious about beyond the sanctuary of meditation, are you aware of any either self-organized circle of sharing among the community members that they practice deep listening to each other, or are you integrating that kind of deep listening practice in the community you're building?
I would love to say that we've got groups or events that are specifically focused on deep listening, but right now we don't have a lot of that kind of member focused deep listening practice on an ongoing basis as an organized, you know, class or event. And I would certainly love to make that more of a priority for us, because just knowing what happens in the space up at our front desk, and, you know, that answer was written in large part based on what happens for our front desk staff when we're welcoming people in the door, when we greet them, ask what they're looking for, what their expectations are, what brought them in today. And in that space of on a one-to-one interaction, hearing people's stories and just remarkably hearing how so many people are ready, willing to be very transparent, very vulnerable, and share with us what they're going through, why they're in that day. That has been so... I don't know what the proper words would be. It's like a heart explosion for me personally to hold that space and as you said, practice that deep listening and just allowing them to feel heard and held. And if there was a way to put that into more of a group aspect, I would love to do it. I will admit that that's not something that we've explored too much and made a priority, though we have heard quite a bit that our members would like to have more community programs instead of, you know, most of our services are pretty individual, meaning, you know, as a meditation practice, people are coming in, they're sitting quietly by themselves, and they're leaving on their own, that we would very much like to be incorporating a lot more activities and group events where people can share. What you've described, a kind of deep listening circle, would need a lot of intention around it to make sure that everyone understood here's the parameters of why we're coming together and sort of the house rules of how we're going to treat one another, which I know everyone would be able to hold the space. It's actually just not anything that we've been able to, or we just haven't put it on the calendar yet. So I actually thank you for that idea.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there was a question that came in on the web form from Maya Frohm, and she says, "How do you practice in mindfulness in your day to day?"
I would say that is thankfully almost becoming a baseline sort of awareness on my part, much out of necessity as out of intention, meaning I'll have a formal practice, you know, sitting 20, 30 minutes. I won't say I sit every day, doing my best about 5 days a week. But the mindfulness aspect of that question, how do I practice mindfulness every day? It really has become a situation for me where every time I am greeting people in the door, when I'm taking phone calls, when I am leading a class, that I would say that by now a lot of the meditation techniques have started to take hold for me, where I can feel when my heart rate is starting to climb. Even before this call, I had a meditation session with a group, and I was anticipating the call and recognizing where my mind was starting to plan and my mind was starting to be concerned, and I can feel my heart rate rising, or doing breath techniques and feeling it come down. And that's sort of been something that is more easily integrated in my everyday life, where it could be a phone call starting to get a little tense, or a conversation or a discussion with a coworker or a student or a family member that is going to be difficult, where I'm feeling the emotional tone in my body. I'm noticing where the thoughts are going, if it's feeling very cloudy and anger, or if I'm able to stay open, a little more neutral, a little more forgiving. So I can't really give a specific technique. I'd say my mindfulness that I'm noticing on a fairly regular basis just has me able to really see for myself, what is my relationship to this moment-by-moment experience? And am I, you know, becoming tight? Am I staying soft? Where is my mind leading me into an assumption or a belief or some sort of expectation? So the days certainly bring plenty of material, hour by hour, to work with on that.
And Michelle, it looks like there is a question in the queue.
Oh, yes. Okay, so let's go to the next question.
Hi, Sierra and Raul. This is Mission New York. Very much enjoying listening to today's conversation. My ears perked up when you mentioned you had been a massage therapist. I was a long-time massage therapist, now retired, and I'm aware of the power of touch in stress reduction, and I'm just curious, does massage play any part in the services in your meditation center for people who are looking for stress reduction in their lives? Because I know that the two of them combined are terribly powerful.
I am so glad you asked that. In the early days, they did. As I was, starting up the center, and it was a very nascent type of enterprise, in my transition from massage therapist to working full-time at the meditation center, there was a period of about, it might have been 2 years, where I was doing massage in the center. It was either my former clients with full body massages just in a small room off to the side, but I was trying to incorporate it more into the center itself, and we were doing clothed massages, which looked like foot massages, hand massages, and scalp massages, which are a nice way, those are, as you well know, some of those hot spots where we can really relax people in a very short period of time. And again, playing into the idea that we wanted to keep everyone with an extreme sense of comfort in the space, not even requiring any clothing to be taken off, was a nice aspect to those types of treatments. I'm just really laughing, actually, that your question came up. I tend to think that I make decisions based on if I get an answer in threes, and your question is the third of a
really
of a three that I've been recently contemplating bringing it back, to be perfectly honest. Just for me personally, I miss giving scalp massages, and I know that what happens to a person when they are on the table in that surrender mode and maybe for the first time remembering that there is a body beneath their head and, you know, the breathing is slowed down, all of the chemicals in the body are changing, you know, the flight or flight is off, and someone walked in the door yesterday and asked if I did massage, and I thought, how peculiar. I've been retired for several years now. We don't advertise that at all. And now your call, so I'm going to have to pay attention.
Yeah, cause, and especially like for people who are coming in who are kind of anxious about being there, maybe if some kind of, upon entering kind of scalp or shoulder massage would get them so relaxed that they would lose their fear or anxiety and totally that would work with their being more receptive to what there is there for them. And I think what you're doing is wonderful, and bless you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And a lot of massage clients are going to thank you as well if it turns out that we implement that.
When was the last time you had a massage?
Oh, well, I'm pleased to announce it was last week when I was on vacation, but before that, it was a terribly long time.
Okay. Thank you, Sierra.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mish, for that question. And Sierra, we have a question from our web forum from Carol. So she asked, as distinguished from the late Alan Watts, who expressed disdain for the aching knees branch of a Buddhist meditation, and I think you mentioned also in your previous conversation with Raul, so she asked, your chair project speaks for comfort as a positive aspect of meditation. Can you give us a little more description of the chair?
Oh, the chair, sure. Let me not forget that there is an actual website, myuseat.com. But the chair is an ergonomically designed, adjustable, portable meditation chair that allows people to sit at various heights. So two things are important for getting someone's posture in proper alignment for long periods of sitting, and that is that the seat actually should be tilted forward so that the pelvis is tilted so that we're getting the proper stacking of the vertebrae in the spine. Essentially, we want the spine and the skeletal system to be holding the back upright rather than the muscles being required. So a forward tilt of the seat and then an adjustable height means that maybe you're the height of my mom, who is 5 foot barely anything, and versus my dad, 6'5". That a single height of seat is not going to properly fit people of various heights. So it's really important to, in addition to having the tilted seat, that the height is adjustable, bringing your feet flat on the floor. So it's adjustable that way. We also maybe over-designed it in a positive way where you can actually lower the seat all the way to the floor or several inches off the floor such that it can also be used for a kneeling posture and for a cross-legged posture. And that was in large part looking around at other meditation centers where for the most part, all meditation centers really just have a bunch of folding chairs or conference chairs in the back row, and they certainly don't serve the needs of people of many, many different sizes and shapes. And for practitioners who are sitting for a long period of time, sometimes you'll spend a portion of your meditation session in one posture, and then if things are getting sore or tight and you don't want to just end your meditation session, but rather just change to a different posture. We wanted a chair that would adjust based on someone's needs day to day and in a meditation center, something that could be used for absolutely everyone, regardless of how they're sitting. So happy to do a little promotional blitz there.
Yeah.
It almost seems like the seat itself is an invitation, you know, just lowering the barrier, the hurdle for people to kind of get engaged with the practice. You know? Beautiful. Mm-hmm. It makes sense. Makes a lot of sense that it came out of your center and the spirit that informed it.
Yeah, to reduce unnecessary suffering.
And, that's right. That's right.
I have another question that that you mentioned the one thing on your bucket list is participating in a poetry slam. To me, like a poetry slam is like to be fully alive, to express yourself. And between, like the question I always have for myself is being so active and fully alive and sitting in a meditation in such a with quiet mind. So how do you dance, or how do you interpret this to set settings?
Yeah, that is a good juxtaposition of the two. Maybe it speaks to a person's innate comfort level. So for me, really diving into the dark corners of myself, of my mental habits and of my mind, isn't nearly as daunting as standing in front of a group of people sharing an original poem. You know, on some level that seems far more terrifying, vulnerable. So for others, I know it would be just the opposite, like, oh, no big deal. We've got a captive audience out there. The mic is warm. I've rehearsed this poem 100 times, but please, dear God, don't make me sit down and close my eyes and be quiet for 20 minutes, you know? So I guess if nothing else, I'm very aware that there are many growth opportunities out there in the spoken word poetry slam world. I just haven't gotten myself there yet.
I'm sure you also had that one-line message for the world where you said, your quote was, "Be ruthless in your self-examination. Compassion is always the final result." Can you tell me about that, sort of how that quote came about for you?
Yeah, my students will agree that one of my favorite words to use, one of my favorite adjectives, is ruthless. I heard that from another teacher, and honestly, the context has escaped me now. I don't remember what teacher it was or even his quote, but it was about this idea of there are no shortcuts and there are no easy routes, that essentially the only way you're going to get through this is to be ruthless with yourself. And we use it oftentimes with this ruthless wisdom that doesn't get you off the hook easily. And so in this ruthless examination, it means, you know, we might go down a couple layers and say, oh, I've worked through that, or this one's a little uncomfortable for me. I'll work with that. Maybe it's anger or grief or judgment or, you know, fill in the blank of all of our top personal attributes. You know, I'll work here just so long as it's challenging but still in the realm of comfortable, but anything deeper, anything thicker, heavier, darker than that, no, you know, I'll be complacent with just doing my self-examination to a certain point. And usually it's, you know, this assumption that if you get down too far, too deep, if it's that uncomfortable, that surely the outcome won't be good. You know, essentially, I think we're held back by the assumption that if we dig too deeply and we go down too far where it's really, really uncomfortable, that that's a sign that the outcome is going to be horrendous. And so I guess with this quote, it was my reminder to myself also that keep going, no matter how thick and heavy it is down there, that we are assured that the end result will be this free-flowing, uninhibited compassion for ourselves, which of course will extend to everyone else who's gone through any type of life experience or particularly some type of self-examination. And that it's, you know, the component is, don't stop. You've got to be ruthless with yourself, and sort of the assurance that it will all be okay in the end. The level of compassion that will be the result is more than worth it.
It's almost like, you know, the common perception is that vulnerability is actually an indication of weakness, but the capacity to touch that vulnerability and sort of bring it out in the open is actually an act of tremendous strength and courage.
Absolutely. Brene Brown had it. It was one of my heroes. I think her teachings on vulnerability are extraordinary.
Mm. Yeah, and almost the way in which you kind of normalize anxiety and grief and depression on the website, you know, this act of telling people that they're not alone, I guess this goes hand with that, you know, exploring deeply their themselves to see what's there.
I would love than to normalize all of that, honestly. I think it's a great shame that most people feel that if they're feeling imperfect in any way, that there's something uniquely wrong with them. And the fact that everyone is feeling that something is uniquely wrong with them, yet nobody's talking about it. If we only knew how much everyone was wrestling with these exact same emotions, that would remove more than half of the difficulty and challenge with it.
Mm.
So we have yes. Raul, do you have a question too?
Oh, go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off, Cheryl. Sorry about that.
Oh, yeah. I just mentioned Carol was asking the website about the chair. I think I will include that, all the information on the email, the follow-up email. So, and also, it's close to the end of our call, and I would ask you, Sierra, what as a larger community in of service space, how can we support your work?
Mm. Well, knowing that many of you are not in Denver, may not ever have a chance to visit my sanctuary, I would say, if anyone is interested in co-ops, there's a lot of information about co-ops as a business model. I would be more than happy to personally share resources and what I've learned if people are curious about how their own endeavors and their own grassroots movements might benefit from learning about co-ops. And other than on, you know, the business side, I think what helps us all is simply letting everyone know that there is tremendous benefit from slowing down, getting quiet, beginning or enhancing your own meditation practice, and that no minute spent in that sort of quiet contemplation is ever wasted. It's never unproductive, and that our own sort of societal, universal hopes and progress is made just little by little with each person taking time for themselves.
Mm. Yeah, thank you so much for the work you do and the service you do for the world and expand that community and attune to more quiet minds. Which is in this society right now is so important. And thank you so much for sharing your work and your service with us today. And I feel very inspired about how meditation and the community building transformed your life and many others. And also the ruthless self-examination and the compassion for all and your exploration the different forms of serving the larger community from for-profit to co-op and not-for-profit, and especially your commitment to create a lively community by empowering all the community members to play vital roles to co-create a lively community. That's very inspiring to me and I think to many others on this call.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you to the whole service space community. It's been fun sharing my little corner of the world with you. I certainly appreciate the time.
Yeah, thank you, Sierra, and thank you, Raul, for this such an engaging conversation today. Now I will unmute all lines, and we can all shout together. I will say 1, 2, 3, then we shout together, thank you, Sierra McNamara. So let me, 1, 2, 3.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sierra.
Thank you, Sierra. Wonderful.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Namaste.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.